for joining us on the D-Spot today and for your amazing groundbreaking work that really supports the embrace of the sacred feminine. Welcome, Peter Canova.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you. You know, I met you last month at my talk at the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, and I was really impressed with your enthusiasm and energy, so I'm very happy to be on the show today.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate you taking time out of all of your speaking engagements and all of the amazing writing that you're doing, et cetera, to be with us here on the D-Spot today. So I kind of gave people a little overview about your background and what brought you to Pope Annalisa, but I know there's a million things that I didn't say in that. Do you want to give us, just to catch us up to speed a bit, a brief kind of your version of what brought you to meet this incredible being, Pope Annalisa, and kind of what brought you to us today? Can you kind of give us a little overview in your own words?
Well, I think you gave a pretty good description about my background and some of the personal experiences I had that put me on the path to eventually writing Pope Annalisa. But, you know, I've had in my meditations and my introspective moments, a lot of themes about our lives have always kind of run through my head. As I began to research and meditate some of these subjects, and I came across this universal ancient spiritual tradition, and I started connecting the dots, and I started seeing how our Judeo-Christian legacy was originally part of this tradition, and that it was very feminine orientation, and how we lost that, how we kind of got off track, and is somewhat kind of the story of our soul journey as human beings. And there were so many themes that I said, if I write a self-help book, there's a lot of people out there doing that, and they're probably doing it better than I can. But there's so many magnificent themes involved here that I think can be helpful and instructive to people. I decided to put it in the form of an epic novel and let those themes come out through the lives of the characters. And these characters, this is part of a trilogy, incidentally, called the First Souls Trilogy, Pope Annalisa being the first book. And the First Souls is about the first spirit to fall into the consciousness of materiality and ultimately into the physical body. And it's really the story of you and me and really all of humanity about our origin, destiny, and purpose. And I felt something that was sort of that sweeping, let's say, could best be told in the form of a fictional novel through the action and through the lives of these characters.
Beautiful, beautiful. And you do such a wonderful job. I mean, it's a page-turner, it's a thriller, and the chapters are nice and short, and it moves so quickly. I just found this quote. This wasn't in your book, but I thought it related to it. This comes from The Confederacy of Dunces by Jonathan Swift. When a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign, that all the dunces are in confederacy against him. In your book, you've got the Catholic higher-ups, we've got the Pope, and we've got all of those who work with him in the Vatican, and some of them are open to him. The Pope has I'm not going to give away the whole story, as you'll have to read the book, those of you who are listening, but the Pope has a direct experience with Annalisa, so he's a believer. But there's so many that are so violently opposed to Annalisa, what she represents. First of all, the fact that she's a woman. Secondly, that she's black. Third, that she actually creates real miracles, not pretend miracles and not just the accoutrements that kind of look like miracles, but the real thing. Why is there so much hostility against her?
I think that we are asleep, which is what the ancient texts would tell us. We're asleep in the consciousness of materiality, forgetting that there's a higher dimension from which we descend. And on those occasions, when the sublime touches the mundane, when the divine touches our everyday world, it's very hard for people to recognize because it tells a very different story. Much like when quantum physics was a young science and they were discovering the absolutely counterintuitive, bizarre properties of the quantum world, which is our underlying reality, that were so different from our everyday appearances of what we thought reality was, it was very hard for the scientists to believe what they were observing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we have those special souls that come in that have a more clear channel to the divine, and incidentally, I don't place those people on a pedestal above us because I think we all contain, and if we get into the discussion of the ancient wisdom tradition, we'll see this, that we all contain the spark of the divine. But there are souls, let's say, who've read a few chapters ahead. And
yeah,
when they come into the world, it's often very startling. Now, think of Jesus of Nazareth and his ministry. Some people believed him to be the Son of God. Some people believed him to be a healer. Just as many thought he was a sorcerer.
Right.
They couldn't really account for him. There's very different perspectives that people will take once a great being is in our midst. And it's not to say that the people who don't believe that they are what they are bad or evil. It's they're looking at it from a standpoint of their clouded consciousness that they're partially asleep, and somebody's trying to wake them out of that sleep, and that's always a little bit disturbing. Anytime you get woken out of a dead sleep, it's always a little bit disturbing. So I think that Annalisa is much like any of these other figures, like Jesus or other figures, that enlightened figures that have come along, and there's a great divide about her, whether she is a force for good or whether she is a force for evil, and just, you know,
right,
what her agenda is.
Mm. You know, because I work in the realm of dreams, and a lot of people that listen to this show are active dreamers and working within their dreams and how to segue that into making their dreams come true from a dream perspective. And I've talked about this probably on every show so far. One way of interpreting a dream is that every character and every symbol and everything, all the way from the doorknob to the angel, all of them are an aspect of yourself. So what do you think of the perspective that even in this play of this outer play that we're looking at, that there's an Annalisa within all of us, this awakened healer that is gentle and intuitive and completely humanitarian. And there's also that dense part of us that just doesn't want to budge. Even when everything's on fire and Rome is burning, we still think, no, stay the course, don't change anything, even if it's not working. What do you think of that possibility of all of those aspects being within us?
Well, I certainly think that's true. During the course of writing Pope Annalisa, I soon came to realize that almost every character in that book was some reflection of myself, some part of my personality, and what
right,
it really turned out to be was a little bit of a catharsis. I was starting to learn about myself through the characters and through the writing of the book. And in essence, I was, and I think this is the cosmic play that we do with the divine. We are parts of the divine who essentially are looking at the divine mirror back at ourselves. And we are shedding light. We are shedding that divine light back on ourselves as a reflective mirror would, to learn about ourselves and learn new things about ourselves. And I think it's part of the human condition that it's sort of like, well, you know that many of the stories, many of the great stories with the mythic qualities involve the heroes who are living in, you know, a somewhat idyllic surrounding. Like, well, let's take Lord of the Rings. Frodo is living in the Shire, a great little place, merry little people. And then something disturbing comes along and enters his consciousness that's very different from the world of the Shire around him, and it draws him out of the Shire and into a world that's often dark and often troubling and often dangerous. But at the end of that journey, he grows and he has a realization.
Right.
And that's the exciting part and the challenging part of life, because, yes, there's the comfort of our home, but if we never leave our home, we're trading a certain amount of comfort for growth and enlightenment. And so I think that that's a little bit of the contradiction that you're hinting at.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Well, it's all, I mean, I've been such within myself looking at all of these aspects, and I think we shun that which is too dark and we shun that which is too light, but when we can bring them together, there can be healing. I mean, the Annalisa character, the Pope Annalisa character, even before she becomes the Pope, she so there's unique qualities about her that I feel like I'm going to, that Annalisa is going to live with me for the rest of my life. Because that in reading Pope Annalisa, I feel like I could actually feel her presence. And she's a fictional character based on, she's the future incarnation of Mary Magdalene. So Mary Magdalene was real. So I don't feel completely crazy in having a connection with a fictional being, because she's not really fictional. But there's a softness and a gentleness and a phenomenal power. And I feel like there is a place where I connect with her almost like she's with me right now. And I had a challenging moment yesterday, for example, with someone that I was dealing with. And because Pope Annalisa has been all around me, I actually kind of invited her in to see the situation through her eyes. And there was such a melting of my own ego and my own hurt and pain that I feel like I was able to kind of drop it more easily. So great job in creating such a three-dimensional or multi-dimensional character.
Well, you know, talking about what we just spoke about sort of, you know, stepping out of our everyday world.
Yeah.
With Annalisa, it was almost a little bit of the opposite. In the book, Annalisa spends a lot of time in the still place. Essentially, she's almost in a constant meditative state, in touch with the divine. And Annalisa's lesson is that God does not want us to be too holy either. So mm-hmm. Annalisa has to step out of that world. And she has to step into the world of the sublime, into the world of the mundane. She has to get her hands dirty, in effect.
Right.
And you see, this is the two-way street between spirit and humanity, because originally spirit stepped down from its high station into the consciousness of separation, from the consciousness
right.
of unity, and then from the consciousness of separation into the consciousness of experience in a physical body. The tarot card, the Fool. If for those who are familiar with the classic tarot, like the Rider deck, shows a wanderer almost with like a little bag and a stick over his shoulder, kind of almost like a hobo, about
right.
to step off a cliff, and totally oblivious of what's happening. Well, the symbology, and incidentally, the tarot comes from a lot of Gnostic symbology, and we'll talk about the Gnostics in a few minutes.
Yes.
But
yes,
the tarot
yes.
has been symbolic for God. It's God literally flinging itself out into the new experience of separated consciousness and ultimately materiality. It's the game of God, and so you see, God even steps out of its own home in order to experience something totally alien, the way we step out of our physical home in order to experience something divine.
It's so brilliant, because you know we're on the awakening zone, and everyone who's listening, everyone who is a host, all the guests, everything, all roads lead to Rome, ba-dum-bum. All roads lead to how do we wake up? But it's an interesting thing that we started off awake. We are awake beings that chose to sleep. And in some ways, regarding dreams, we sleep every night. And going back to what I was saying in the very beginning about die daily, on some level, it's hardwired into us to die daily, to not be in a constant state of awakeness, but to go to sleep. When we go to sleep, in some way, I can't remember who said it, but it's like a little death every time we sleep, because we're letting go of what was going on all day, all the things that were so important to us by day, we let go of by night when we go into our sleep. But there's something in the setup that we've all created that we intentionally chose to go on this hero's journey, to forget. It's kind of like the prince and the pauper. We wanted to forget that we're really wealthy and that we're really entitled and that we're heir to this great spiritual and physical fortune, so that we could appreciate it in some way. And even
well,
the people that oppose us. Go ahead.
Yeah, that process takes place at all levels, Kelly, because certainly, you know, when we sleep, we're stepping from the conscious into the unconscious. But even during our conscious waking moments, growth really entails a process of self-correction. And self-correction
yeah.
means that you can't fall asleep or you can't get stuck into any one rut. Now, I often, you know, when I'm speaking, I give an example about spiritual growth and religion, the difference between spirituality and religion. If you view your spiritual growth as traveling along a highway, and there's many stops along the highway that you can get off at, And if you go into them, religion will sort of encourage you to punch your ticket at any particular stop, saying, you know, we've got the whole truth, we've got the be-all and end-all. So you sort of accept that, and you get your membership there, and you stop there. But spirituality would really take what they can from that stop and say thank you, and then go on to the next stop and sort of keep going on in a progress so that you'd never take anything that you feel is a truth as the ultimate and the end truth, because it's always going to be superseded by a higher level of knowledge. It doesn't mean that you were incorrect, but it might mean that you're moving higher up the mountain, so you're gaining a greater perspective of the panorama below you. And that's the difference between spirituality and religion. So, you know, a work like Pope Annalisa, for instance, is not meant to be a new religion or a new creed or anything else. It's meant to be a signpost, but you never mistake the signpost for the destination.
Oh, I love that. You're making me, God, so many things are coming to my mind. I'm thinking of when I was a junior in high school, I was in an English literature class, and my teacher reprimanded me. We were interpreting Shakespeare. I think it was Macbeth, or it was one of Shakespeare's stories. It was Macbeth, and I gave my little summary of the story and kind of with a Pollyanna little twist to it. And my teacher screamed at me. She said, Kelly, you are constantly trying to put everything into a little box and wrapping a little pink bow around it and calling it done. It's not done. There's more to the story than just that. Open up and let go.
Yeah, that was probably good advice, because we do tend to put things in those little boxes and get a little self-complacent about it, and that's the point at, you know, where our growth stops.
But to keep going, there's my favorite William Blake quote, I think I have this up on Facebook, is, he who binds himself to joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And I feel like there's that the energy that little poem kind of points to is just to be open and to not have to grab onto something and say, this is it, I'm pulling over, this is the stop, and this is it. This is the highest, this is up the mountain, this is the top, and this is the be-all, end-all. There's more.
Yeah, and I think you know, for spiritually minded people, you know, they're like anybody else. I mean, sometimes spiritually minded people tend to think, well, you know, we've got it better than those people that still believe in religion, and yet they end up getting tied into a particular guru or a particular, you know, started following a particular person. And, you know, the real critical thing, and this is really what I want, this is what I try to do in all my talking and through my books, is not to try and sell somebody a particular system, but to try and get them to understand a framework in which they can further their own spiritual growth, and always, always maintain your own faculty of critical judgment, and so you don't become complacent, or you don't start to think anything has all the answers in this life. I'm not sure there's any such thing as absolute truth in our material plane of existence. Every time I think I've found one, it's always superseded by another truth, and perhaps the only absolute truth really dwells in another dimension, and when we get absorbed into the heart of God, then we realize absolute truth. But I think this world is a proving ground. This world is a testing ground. This world is a school, and if we understand it as such, you know, there's always another lesson to be learned, and keep yourself open to that. That's important.
Thank you. Well said. I love that, being absorbed in the heart of God. That's gorgeous, and I don't know if I quoted you exactly, but that's how it felt to me. So for those who don't know what Gnosticism is, G-N-O-S-T-I-C-I-S-M, Gnosticism, tell us briefly what that is.
Okay. Let me use that as a segue to sort of give you the larger picture behind the Gnostics.
Yeah.
From time immemorial, there was a universal wisdom tradition that was taught in almost every land, and it's been the basis for almost every major religion, both pagan and modern. And the threads of this universal tradition could be found stretching from India to Persia to Egypt to Greece and Rome. Like I say, it all became the basis of spiritual understanding in almost every major culture. And before some of the established religions that we know, the wisdom was taught in mystery schools. Now, mystery schools, think of them almost as like an Ivy League network of colleges that existed in the ancient world. These were academies where initiates would go in and would be given particular courses of spiritual training, where they went through anywhere from 4 to 10 degrees of initiation, something similar to, say, what the modern Freemasons go through with their 32 different degrees of initiation. And they were in contact with one another from all the way from the Celtic lands and the Druids and the British Isles, to the Far East and India. These mystery schools were in contact with one another. When the Gnostics themselves were actually the Western branch of this mystical tradition. The Gnostics were around before Christ, before Christianity. But when Jesus started his ministry in Palestine, they readily embraced Jesus and Christianity as being the newest and highest expression of this ancient tradition. So they didn't see Christianity as something new that was just kind of plopped on the scene from outer space, out of nowhere. It was, they saw it as a continuation, a new revelation in one of the many waves of revelation that come from divine throughout our history. And they embraced Christianity, became the first Christians. And the Gnostics themselves were the mystical hidden church of Christianity. Christianity was kind of interesting. In the early days, there were really two Christianities. There was the outer church that was typified in Jesus' parables, like the Sermon on the Mount, what he would teach to the masses. But there was another teaching going on in private to the disciples and to those people who were called the spiritually elect or the spiritually mature, the ones who are ready to receive these complex and deep mystical teachings. And how do we know that this is true? Well, it says it right in the Bible. In the book of Mark and Matthew and several of the other Gospels, it says right there that, you know, unto you, unto them I teach in parables, but unto you I give the mysteries of the kingdom. We also know from writings of the early church fathers like Clement of Alexandria and Origen that there was a secret gospel that was primarily oral, that was given mouth-to-mouth, face-to-face to those who were spiritually ready to receive it. And this kind of twofold teaching of outer public teaching and an inner mystical teaching wasn't just common to Christianity. I mean, Buddhism had it, even Judaism had it. You had the Torah or the law, which was the outer form of Judaism, and you had the Nefesh Nishtara, which were the secret teachings that were that the Jews had that were given to the spiritually mature. So there, you know, throughout most of our religions, there were two levels being taught there. And essentially, unfortunately, in the history of the Gnostics, the outer church, once it married the Roman Empire, couldn't tolerate the mystics anymore because the mystics had no need for a hierarchy, which the outer church had evolved, all the bishops and the priests and so forth. So over a period of centuries, the Gnostics were destroyed, and that's why, unfortunately, many people don't know about them. We've recovered some information through some incredible finds in the Egyptian desert, some of their gospels, and that's how we're starting to get light shed on the Gnostics and Mary Magdalene. But that's a quick history of the Gnostics.
Wow, well said, Peter. You're so articulate. Can you tell us what the Immaculate Rejection is?
Well, that's kind of a term that
I love. That.
I mean, you know, anybody that's been brought up as a Catholic, and incidentally, let me just hasten to say that Pope Annalise is not a Catholic book. It just uses the Catholic Church as a vehicle to tell a universal tale of spirit that is common to all humanity. And so I hope those who, you know, are unfamiliar with the book itself don't sort of read this as like, well, you know, gee, this is a Catholic kind of thing, and it's not at all. You know, in the Catholic Church, you have the Immaculate Reception, which is, you know, essentially to do with Mary, the Mother Mary and the virgin birth of Jesus. But the Immaculate Rejection was really Mary Magdalene. She's the lost woman of the Bible. And there was a whole history of the feminine leaders of the church that was erased from history. We can get into that in a few minutes. But that was really tied, you know, the story of Mary Magdalene and the woman of the early church, again, is really tied into something deeper, and that is the whole evolution of the sacred feminine, or the loss of the sacred feminine, we can say in some ways. When I want to take everybody back, if you can sort of close your eyes for a minute and imagine this, that when spirit consciousness first embodied in a human form. We were young then. Consciousness was still close to us. The divine seed of consciousness was still close to us. When the first human beings opened their eyes in consciousness, in a physical world with physical eyes, everything must have seemed magical to them. It must have seemed mysterious, the clouds, the stars, the very earth itself. They felt their way. Early humans felt their way through the earth. They were tied in with the rhythms and the pulses of the earth. And this was all very feminine in orientation, the way things would, you know, would grow and you know, out of a shoot would grow up into a plant or a tree. I mean,